is in neuroscience at MIT, worked with people with brain injuries of various sorts, and tried to do brain behavior comparisons. I've worked with animal models. But I also spent my primary career working for the government, for NASA, the Office of Naval Research, DOD, and also FAA. And in that role as a professional program manager, we gave away money to people to do work. I spent a lot of time with people in cognitive science, coming up with computer simulations of human information processing and decision making that could test theories of human and information processing. So that's the computational approach and angle I have. But we also invested in bio-inspired robotic systems, autonomy, everywhere I went. Even at the FAA, I spent a couple of years there where autonomous systems were very important to integrate into the civilian aviation system. So having given that caveat, I wanted to, this is an overview, you know, why is it important? Why is there a big hype about it? What's the wave all about that we're riding right now? A lot of the questions that I'm addressing were partly because of the conversation that we had last summer. You know, what is intelligence? What is artificial intelligence? What are we afraid of? When is it going to happen? And what's going to look like? And ultimately, if you extend it out into some indeterminate future, it's going to redefine what it means to be human. So this talk is meant to be somewhat provocative, and that's where I'm going. I want to emphasize that there's a lot of really fantastic stuff going on right now, very successful, particularly in a more narrow artificial intelligence sense. But the fear that emerges is for primarily for the longer-term risks, the potential for computers and computing systems to become smarter than their human caretakers. In fact, the roles could be reversed. So we'll talk about that later in the talk. So why is AI important? These are sort of convenient foils. Russia, Putin, China. They're pushing very hard, and we know that Putin's hackers have been very successful at influencing world events through software systems. But the U.S., of course, has always been a leader in technology innovation and artificial intelligence systems. So, you know, artificial intelligence is the future. Whoever leads in this sphere will rule the world, basically. China's investing a tremendous amount of money in this. International industry, including American companies, are scooping up researchers in this related fields, which makes it harder for the free exchange of information because of proprietary issues. I also wanted to mention that as we move forward, that the distinction between real and fake news is becoming blurred. And I think we're all familiar with that. Using social media, you know, when I was at the Office of Naval Research, one of the things that we studied was looking at how networks arise for, like, the Arab Spring, looking at communication patterns. And it turns out that with things like Facebook, you can create a flash mob by just pretending that there are 15,000 followers that are going to meet at a certain time and place, and then other people will show up. Bots, software robots, it was kind of funny at the time of our August conversation, our president retweeted a tweet from one of his super fans on Twitter, and of course that reached 35 million of President Trump's followers, and then it turned out that the person who was the author of that was in fact not a person, and it was traced back to what we think are Russian hackers. So it's just an example of the ways that artificial intelligence, even in its current form today, can lead to unintended consequences and can fool a lot of people. What are the long-term risks? And this is really why I got more interested in this, is because there's just been this hoopla about people like Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates, many others, who are concerned with this issue of the existential risk, long-term risk, to the human race of the possibility of intelligent machines evolving faster than human biology allows us to evolve. There's a guy named Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher at the University of Oxford, who was sort of an intellectual leader in worrying about existential risk, including the possibility of a superintelligence that will take over. And his position, he's not really a technologist, but his position is that if we don't blow each other up, we don't have some sort of catastrophic end to the technology changes that we see, what can be invented will be invented. So his position, which I think is a reasonable position in the long run, is that if it can be invented, it will be invented. So we should be thinking about those possible outcomes because of the significant existential risks that they pose to the human race. That's their position. So this whole idea of having a machine capability for self-improvement could potentially outpace human potential. And, you know, this is the fear: intelligent machines becoming the dominant life form on the planet. So this is where the hype comes in. But, you know, if you think forward, you know, to 100 years from now, looking at where we've been in the last 10 years, what are we capable of? And what are we capable of accepting and embracing as people, as technology evolves and as we integrate with technology? Could it happen soon? Well, you know, intuitively, I would say probably not. However, your intuition may be a very poor guide to prediction. So this is not a data slide. Always reluctant to put up anything that doesn't have numbers associated with it. But this is a conceptual representation of the rate of progress over the last 1,000 years. And it's from a very interesting blog by this guy, Tim Urban. It's a Wait But Why article, so I recommend that you take a look at it. He's got a lot of different, he's got a collection of a lot of different ideas that have motivated a lot of thinking around this. So the idea here is that human progress builds on itself, and it's not a linear, it's an exponential function. If we're right here at present day, and you're basing your prediction on your recent history, for me that would be 40 years, for many of you that might be 10 years, that the slope will be flat and your projection will not take into account the actual shape of the accelerating technology function. So that's trajectory based on past growth. That's probably me, you know, with a 60-year lifespan. But if you had a 30-year lifespan, presumably you wouldn't be anchored by your early experience, and you'd have a better prediction. So even if you were able to accurately gauge the pace of technology change today, you'd still be underestimating where we'd be in the future because the rate of change is changing, it's accelerating. So there's a lot of reason to think that it's as human beings, we're linear thinkers, it's very difficult to make a projection based on our intuition, but that's where technology could go. Having said that, there are many obstacles to deployment of these new technologies that will maybe slow things down. For example, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about driverless cars, right? So and when is that going to happen? Well, the truth is that the cars on the road today, a lot of them are going to be on the road 20 years from now. At least I take care of my car, so I'm expecting to be able to do that. And that there's not going to be a time when all of a sudden everything is driverless. You know, maybe that'll evolve later, but what's really going to happen is that the technologies associated that would support driverless cars are happening today in the luxury cars. You know, the lane keepers, the automatic stop, if you see a kid, if your car sees a kid going behind you and you can't see him in your blind spot, this kind of thing. So as those technologies become more reliable and more trusted, people will start taking them for granted, so it'll become less and less a leap to go to an automated system. Going back to, you know, the questions that were raised last summer, you know, what is intelligence? And, you know, this could be a whole talk by itself. You know, simply speaking, it's an ability to acquire and apply knowledge and skills. It's got a huge range from simple intelligence to more complex intelligence, but even a simple intelligence, like an insect, it's possible to develop very complex behaviors from simple elements in a group. So, for example, insects, you know, can build hives, they can build termite mounds, they can have very coordinated behaviors. One of my friends used to work on the sociology of ant colonies. You know, they're amazing animals. And the DOD, of course, has been investing in that, and so has commercial industry, and looking at swarms of cooperative behavior of very simple elements to be able to create really complex outcomes. If you focus on the human intelligence, there's just a whole list of things that we normally think about when we think of human intelligence. This is very big, and I maybe I'll do another talk one of these days about my theory about how the brain works and how the mind works. We like to complete patterns at all levels of the nervous system and behavior, all the way from visual pattern recognition to storytelling, trying to make sense of our world, fitting it into an internal model. Problem solving and reasoning, of course, this is a big target for AI over the many decades. Insight and generalization, fluid intelligence and working memory loops, natural language, motor and perceptual learning, habit formation, even for complex skills. There's a lot of work now that suggests there's a neural transformation from cortical networks to cortical thalamic networks to striatal networks as you acquire habits. But that's not the only thing. There's much bigger things. Social communication in societies, implicit biases, probably heard a lot, artistic expression, various kinds of language skills, emotional awareness, empathy. So these are all things that are really hard problems. And just common sense and strategic thinking. How do you get that in a machine? We don't know how we get it in humans. So moving on from that, what is artificial intelligence? Well, this is a machine computing systems that perform tasks normally requiring animal or human intelligence. So animal intelligence could be a lot of those things that we were talking about, pattern recognition, cooperative behavior, those kinds of things. It can be embodied in robots, but let's not think about robots. Robots are just a special case. They're a vehicle, just like a computer is a vehicle. Social media app is a vehicle for potentially intelligent behavior and interaction. These software systems can be software, they can be hardware, they can be wetware. You can have biological systems that are engineered to do information processing. And there's interactions among those in the real world. There are a lot of different approaches, and I can't talk about them all, but this idea of deep learning from the ground up, instead of going from a rule-based top-down, growing your system, letting it train itself, pattern analysis, can really produce very fast and powerful machines. And this is a very important thing, I think, that the idea that these entities, these agents, these systems, don't exist in isolation. They're all networked to something. They have to have a data source. They have to have an algorithmic base. They learn, so they can learn from other objects in their environments. And what are those other objects? Sensors, algorithms, data, other AIs, and interacting with people. People may be the best way for these systems to learn how to behave in concert with people. So the current trajectory, I'll have more to say about each of these three things, but this is not really separate categories there, and it's not really a continuum. I'll talk more about these examples of the tremendously successful systems that we have now. Special purpose, they're ubiquitous, and interestingly, this is John McCarthy. I think this is a 1956 quote. John McCarthy, I believe, was one of the, may have been the person that coined the term artificial intelligence. And he said, you know, the problem with artificial intelligence is that the goalposts keep receding, because once it works, yeah, we just accept it. That's the way it is. It's no longer artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is something else. So there's a lot of that going on now. I think we should maybe take a moment and recognize what's working now and why it's so fantastic. Then there's this general purpose AI, sometimes called human-level AI, which is not exactly the same thing. It's aspirational. I think in some examples, we have good models of how humans process information, and we can run them separately. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But, you know, this is that hard problem. How do you, common sense, strategic thinking, empathy, emotional behavior, social communication, all those things we talked about is hard. And then the super AI, this is what people are afraid of. Some people are afraid of this. And that's the idea of it's not happening now. There are people working on this. It's not hard to imagine a technology advance that would enable these computers to learn on their own. And, you know, is that going to happen in 10 years? Is that going to happen in 200 years? I don't know. We'll talk more about that. Yes, sir.
Just one question. The narrow AI, would you include in that, for example, a robot that does one specific function and only one specific function, like on an assembly?
Let me go on to address that specific question right in the next slide. And I'll get to that. There are many examples, and as I was saying, it is hard. If you were asking that question 20 years ago, you'd say, well, wow, this machine system can see can recognize a bolt or a piece of a car coming down the line, know where it is in space, grab it, figure out that it needs a certain level of positioning and tension and the torque and incline it, and that would be a pretty freaking smart machine. Now we're going, well, is that really intelligent? What is intelligence? No, to go back to the question. So to the extent that it can accommodate uncertainty and come up with a solution, I think that might be an angle on that. I don't know exactly what to say. Google, I just watched a discussion with Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Alphabet, the Google spinoff set of companies. He was talking about diagnosing diabetic retinopathy, deterioration of the retina associated with diabetes. And it turns out that with their systems now, that they can, with the information that a clinician would get about an individual patient, they can make a diagnosis that's correct 99% of the time. And the current clinical standard is about 90%. And what's the difference? Well, the difference is that the normal clinician only sees a few hundred, maybe 1,000 patients in his or her lifetime. Whereas these deep learning systems, they've got enormous amounts of data from which to abstract these patterns. And that's been one of the legs up for these big companies like Facebook, Microsoft, Google. They have access to this enormous corpus of data from which they can abstract patterns. And that's a very key thing. So some of the narrow examples that you're going to be familiar with, I think. Google's not the only company doing this, but Google Search. Now, it looks at your past behavior. It looks at patterns of people like you. Comes up with suggestions. It completes your phrases for you, which is a little eerie, somewhat irritating, but generally it's kind of useful. Google Natural Language and Speech Recognition, being able to talk to Siri, it's fantastic. It's really great. Google Translate. They had a step change in their capability in the last 3 years because of using artificial neural networks that came out of the Google Brain project. And I have to say about Translate, this whole idea of machine translation is a venerable goal that I recall reading about, not this old, but back in the 50s, sound spectrograms and speech synthesis first came out. You could see the sound pattern of language and, you know, what consonants look like, what vowels look like, what words look like, co-articulation. And so people thought, oh, hey, we're going to have machine translation just from looking at sound spectrograms. You know, within 10 years, problem solved. Well, it turns out that that opening up that box created the whole field of linguistics that, you know, we had to think about surface structure, deep structure, you know, what's common across languages, developmental issues. I mean, it's just amazing. It's a really, really hard problem. Now, my wife is from France. My mother-in-law doesn't speak English very well, and I speak French about the same. But I can text her now. We text each other. She's 93 years old. And I use Google Translate to get my ideas into rough form, and I ship it off to her. And she can't understand why I can't speak French when I speak to her. So let's recognize what we've got. This is something that's happened in the last 3 years. It's really phenomenal. And then there's Google Maps, navigation. Back in the 90s, can you imagine holding a GPS system in your pocket that would tell you with a map where you need to go? And, oh, by the way, you can take some other routes. And, oh, by the way, there's an accident here. There's a little tie-up here. And I use it to get here because it knows where the buses are in Madison. Google image recognition, you know, face recognition, image recognition and visual machine vision has been an important problem for a long time. So a lot about Google. I guess there is a pattern there. But there's a lot of competition, and it's not just American competition. I think this is pronounced Baidu. Is that right? So that's a Chinese company that's been scooping up a lot of Google employees, among others, to create a competition. And they have access to the billions of people that live in China that use their networks. So IBM Watson, now that's very interesting. IBM Watson that did the Jeopardy, beat the Jeopardy champion. I don't know if you remember that. But what is IBM Watson? It's actually not that smart, in my opinion, but it is a conglomeration of AIs that are federated together that have access to the Internet really fast, can come up with answers to questions, or is it questions to answer? I forgot how that works with Jeopardy. But, so I was talking to those guys. They gave a talk at the Naval Research Laboratory about 6 or 7 years ago, and I said, what's next? How about discourse analysis? How about interacting? So, when you have a question about a problem, you ask a question and then you home in on a better question. And then you interact with somebody, you extract information. So even though we've got this enormous amount of data, and it's really fantastic, they're using this for medical diagnosis and we'll apply it to other areas. Could be so much more. I don't think it's that intelligent in the sense that being interactive. We already talked about self-driving cars, Mars exploration robots, smart homes like home thermostats that you can, or security systems that, I can be here and look at my front porch in D.C. and find out who's ripping off my Christmas presents. So I have to say, again, this is a returning theme, these bots don't have to be very smart to be effective. Once they get out there, they start getting retweeted or referenced, the credibility of the source is lost. And the quantity of retweets or the quantity of the messaging that goes on tends to reinforce what people want to hear anyhow. We all have these confirmation biases that we bring to the table. And so if you're thinking about a Turing test, can you tell whether it's human or a machine? People want to believe that it's human. So going on to the general or human level AI, is more general purpose, not product specific. It can generalize to novel situations or similar situations. It can make a judgment and derive an answer or an action based on incomplete data. That could be ambiguous, implicit, or erroneous. It could address all these issues: learning, adaptation, communication, collaboration, and interaction. Now, my own personal experience in interacting with the cognitive science community, they've been using computer simulations to test explicitly theories and predictions based on specific cognitive models. So, and that's been useful for things like intelligent tutoring systems, where you have a computer that has an expert model of some domain, let's say a rule-bound domain like geometry or Lisp tutoring back in the day. It has it presents a problem to a student. The student gets it right or doesn't get it right, and then it's able to interpret that and diagnose what the model of the student is, and then present information that will get them where they need to go. So it's supposed to be a more efficient way of education, and allows self-paced learning that could be an adjunct to more effective classroom training by teachers. These kinds of expert models have been used in systems engineering, simulation-based design, so that instead of building something and putting a human in front of it, figuring out whether it's going to work, you can actually put a simulated human in front of it. You have to bend metal, and you can move forward much more quickly. It's, as I said, able to test theories of human information processing. And it really draws and impacts a broad range of fields. So I think this is, as I was saying, it's aspirational. Understanding, if you're really a psychologist and you want to understand how humans process information, we have a long ways to go. But if you could be doing the same exact thing and be an AI person, and your goal would be to get systems that can actually do things. That's one goal. And so you could say that we're having some great success in this area, but there's a long way to go. The super intelligent AI. It doesn't exist yet. The expectations, because it doesn't exist yet, I can say almost anything I want about it, and people are saying a lot of things about it in the popular press. A lot of that's driven by Hollywood, you know, Terminators, HAL from 2001 back in the day. You know, I think that's a little bit of a red herring in my view, because what it focuses on is a machine intelligence that is a human-like individual entity. You have to worry about one machine. I think what's going to be true is that even though an individual entity could potentially exceed humans in speed, power, complexity, learning, that it's going to be a network system of systems or multiple systems. So it's not going to be, why would you, in this day and age of Bluetooth and wireless connectivity, why would you create an intelligence that was an individual that would have maybe five intelligences in a classroom? Well, of course they're going to be connected. I mean, we're all connected right now, but you could really do it much more efficiently, and you can have a distributed AI that enables an emergent intelligence that is not the same as having an individual intelligence. The idea of self-coding, possibly evolving, we're not there yet, but there are people, Google has a project called AutoML for automated machine learning that was formally initiated last May. Because it's so expensive, time and personnel-wise, to build the code for artificially intelligent systems, what they want to do is they want to automate that process. So they want to build smart machines that can build smart machines. And they're already exceeding the capability of the engineers in Google's AutoML. The evolved systems are beating the ones that were originally coded by its own authors. And then there's this question about autonomous agency. And what is agency, anyhow? You know, I'm sort of making up some of this stuff, but agency to me is the capacity to act with personal consequence for the actor. So that means there is some kind of entity, maybe has goals, maybe has drives, and it wants to achieve something and move forward, so it acts, and that has an impact on its future. It can be unconscious, involuntary, reactive. Could be purposeful and goal-directed. Could be any combination of those. So the kind of capabilities that you want, and as I wrote this down, I realized these are sort of capabilities for life itself. But the ability to sense and respond to your environment, that's true at the single cell level, that's true at the organismic level. You can't create it in a box, a jar, and a shelf. It can learn and adapt, and it can improve and potentially evolve. And that evolution could be on the basis of a singular entity that's getting better itself, or just becoming or a group evolution. So the drivers, survivability, that means that, and self-sustainment, that means the machine wants to live, kind of, wants to continue itself, doesn't want to self-terminate. Curiosity is like detecting novelty and resolving novelty and ambiguity. Completion is kind of goes back to my thinking about the developing a story about the world around you and having a model of the world that makes sense. Self-improvement and efficiency. You want to do things as easily as you can so that you can go on to bigger and better things with the resources you have available to you. And then what's kind of level of agency? Again, this is a simple view of a much larger, complex subject, but you could say that agents, artificial agents, could be dependent on human direction and control explicitly. They could be autonomous within defined parameters, so that people didn't have to pay attention to the details, but once it got out of the envelope, you know, either it would stop itself or it would ring a bell and somebody would come do something about it. Or completely independent of human guidance and control. And I think this idea of control, loss of control, is probably going back to, you know, this question of what are we afraid of, is probably something like that. Runaway, self-improvement or evolution. You know, once you, you know, open Pandora's box, these things could get out and move beyond human capability. It's unbounded by biology. You know, we're very limited because of our lifespan and reproductive life to evolve slower. You know, cultural evolution is a different thing. Scientific evolution, in a way, is a different thing. But artificial intelligence machines don't have the same biological constraint. The idea of fully autonomous, no off switch. So again, this goes back to this idea that if you have a computer on a shelf, it's got a power cord, you just unplug it if you don't like what it's doing. Well, if you've got a system that is a federated system that is connected and to us and to other artificial intelligence, other sensors, algorithms, etc., you may not be able to turn off the switch. You know, we're not really controlling it. There may be unintended consequences. So, for example, if you had a machine in a hospital that was whose goal was to make people happy or something like that, you know, maybe what they would be doing is dumping a lot of opiates into the system as this very simple operational definition. And that wouldn't be what the programmers might have wanted them to do. But there are many examples, you know, from Isaac Asimov, the three laws of robotics, where things could go wrong in ways that you hadn't anticipated. So this last point, and this is a little bit of the fear-mongering, we're afraid of systems that maybe don't understand human values. And at some point, if they're powerful enough, they might not value humans at all. I was having a conversation about the search for extraterrestrial life in the universe, and you know, we haven't found it yet. What should we be looking for? So one thing that we might think of is that humans and biological systems are fragile. You know, we've seen so many extinctions in the last billion years, the last several hundred million years on Earth. You know, humans could easily be wiped off the planet. What if you had machine systems that were more resilient and self-reliant that could survive perhaps longer than human systems could? What about these machine systems? Wouldn't it be easier for a machine to explore the universe? They don't have to worry about radiation. They can go into hibernation for 10,000 years and end up at a different planetary system. So it could be that what you'll end up finding, and again, I know this is going out there quite a bit, but is it be more likely to find a machine intelligence out in the universe that would survive any sort of biological systems that might have created it in the beginning. So, just about done. We can open this up. But where are we at? When could this super AI happen? Well, we've already gone through a lot. You know, the nature, we're still making great strides in understanding what human intelligence actually is and biological intelligence writ large. We've seen that these machine systems, we're using them every day. Narrow AI and network systems are pervasive already, and they will become more so. You know, I don't know whether I could survive without a smartphone in my pocket. Well, I know I could, and I turn it off every once in a while. But. So this idea of deep learning and artificial networks is here today. It's a lot about ground-up analysis of large data systems looking for patterns. Automated machine learning, I mentioned Google ML, the Auto ML program. It's starting. I don't think it's going to be stopping anytime soon. This is something that's going to enable a large number of non-computer scientists, non-experts, to develop artificially intelligent systems for their own purposes. But there are many obstacles to technology development. So it's hard to change the infrastructure that we have. And as I said before, I don't think it's going to be a threshold. In fact, it will be more incremental. So what's it going to look like? AIs are not single independent entities in a bottle on a shelf. They're going to be pervasive, distributed, multi-layered. So you might have some systems working on other systems, smart systems that are working on other systems that are less smart. There's not going to be some sort of Skynet breakthrough where a single system is going to become a sentient. I doubt that's going to happen. Human-level AI is not a required step. So a lot of times when futurists put up their projections, they have, you know, where we are, you know, an insect, then you've got an ape, and then you've got a village idiot, and then you have, you know, Stephen Hawking, and then you have something else. So in order to be able to get to that something else, you don't have to know how the village idiot works or Stephen Hawking works. You can take many paths to get there. It's not a simple continuum. And I think it's very likely that we'll continue to expand our networks and our capabilities for interacting with these systems. We mentioned that given that it's a distributed system, there won't be an off switch. And kind of more importantly, I think people will accept and expect and ultimately embrace these new technologies as we're doing today and take them for granted. And they won't want to turn it off. And then I think there's a further question of if there is an emerging, because intelligence is an emergent property of complex systems, if there's an emerging artificial intelligence that's not a human artificial intelligence, would we even know it when we saw it? I don't know. And that's why it's a good idea for people like Nick Bostrom or Elon Musk or these other people to be focusing on what could happen. Because if we don't have our eyes open, we won't know that it's happened until it's too late. In the future, this is my personal vision of it, and I don't know when it's going to happen, people will continue to become more fully networked with machine systems. We'll continue to have prosthetics for perception, cognition, social interaction. You know, I have a much more a useful memory now that I have a direct line into Wikipedia and other places. Social interaction. You know, my wife and I have a two-city arrangement, and you know, we're connected certainly by phone, by text, by email. We send each other articles all the time. So the social interaction is already being facilitated. We have personal monitoring going on, whether that's direct eye movement. You know, you've got your Apple Face ID instead of your password. You just look at your iPhone, and it knows who you are. There are many kinds of human-machine interaction that are possible, including potentially, as a neuroscientist, I'm interested in neural interactions with machines. And that's coming along in part because of the interest in supporting people that need prosthetic limbs, for example. You might be able to have a system that works off directly brain-controlled or off neural impulses. And finally, artificial avatars and assistants, caregivers and companions. I know back in the early days of the internet when Mosaic and graphical user interfaces were happening, there was a whole subculture, which I'm sure exists today, of people that would come in and play in these ongoing dramas that allowed them to be whatever they wanted to be. So gender didn't make a difference, size didn't make a difference. You could be whoever you wanted to be. And it was difficult to find, you know, to say who it was. Who was your friend out there? Who was your colleague? Who was your companion? I've seen examples of very primitive kind of lifelike dolls that are given to the elderly who might be isolated as a companion and a caregiver. And people love these things. You know, it's great. You know, so I think that, again, people have a tendency to imbue their environment with human-like qualities. And whether that's a doll or a robot or even a bot on the net. And Ray Kurzweil, who's you know very interesting and futurist, has really made a lot of hay or made a lot of name for himself about referencing Moore's law as a paradigm for technology acceleration. So he's transcended the singularity, if you know what I'm talking about. I think what his vision for the future is that there won't be a single point where machines take over and they are the supreme species, intelligent species on the planet. Rather, we'll become more integrated with them. So we'll become cyborgs of sorts that will allow us to really define what it means to be human differently. So in summary, you know, we've had a lot of successes, a lot of stuff's happening right now, really exciting, really happy about it, and there are obviously long-term implications, including this concept of existential risk, which might be very low probability, but I'm glad somebody's paying attention to it. And I think the future will be more and more integration of human and machine systems. So that we'll have a new kind of society that enables a different kind of human being and different kinds of human-machine relationships.